February 14th, 1982, Coconino County, Arizona. The decomposing body of a young woman is found in a remote area alongside Interstate 40, and she is believed to be the victim of a homicide. Since all attempts to identify her are unsuccessful, she becomes a Jane Doe and earns the nickname Valentine Sally. 39 years later, the victim is identified as 17-year-old Carolyn Eaton, who had run away from her home in Missouri. Shortly before her death, Carolyn was seen with an older man at a truck stop, and while this man is suspected of being her killer, he is never identified, and Carolyn's murder remains unsolved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be exploring a crime in which the victim remained a Jane Doe for nearly 40 years, the 1982 murder of Carolyn Eaton. As I'm sure you know, DNA testing and genetic genealogy have led to the identification of a number of John and Jane Does these past few years. In fact, we're currently at the point where it almost seems like a daily occurrence when an announcement is made that one of these decedents has gotten their name back. However, since many of these decedents were homicide victims, identifying them is sometimes only half the battle, since we still don't know who is responsible for killing them. One example of this is the story of a Jane Doe who was found dead in Arizona on February the 14th, 1982, and wound up becoming known by her nickname, Valentine Sally. In 2021, right after the 39-year anniversary of her discovery, it was announced that genetic genealogy had led to Valentine Sally being positively identified as a 17-year-old runaway named Carolyn Eaton, who somehow made a 1,400-mile trip to Arizona from her home in Missouri before she was murdered. What sets this story apart from other cases like this is that Valentine Sally had been identified on a previous occasion as another runaway teenage girl from Florida, but to give you an idea of how much the world of forensic science has evolved, this girl was eventually discovered to be alive, so the investigation was sent right back to square one. Thankfully, we can be certain that no such mistake was made in the identification of Carolyn Eaton, but the authorities are still trying to figure out the identity of the person who killed her, and the most promising candidate is an older man who was seen with Carolyn at a truck stop 10 days before her body was found. There are definitely still a lot of unanswered questions about the circumstances of Carolyn's death, and we're going to be exploring them on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let's now delve into the murder of Carolyn Eaton. Our story begins in Coconino County, Arizona in 1982. On February the 14th, an Arizona Department of Public Safety officer pulled over to the westbound side of Interstate 40 in a remote area 11 miles west from the small town of Williams. The officer was performing a search for a tire which had come off a passing truck, but he wound up coming across the partially nude and decomposed body of a young woman who was lying face down under a cedar tree about 25 feet from the road. She was believed to be between 16 to 24 years old, around 5'4 or 5'5, and between 120 and 125 pounds. The victim was clad only in a pair of size 8 or 9 blue jeans with the brand name Seasons on them, a white 36C size bra, a white sweater with red stripes, and a white handkerchief were lying nearby, though no shoes or socks could be found at the scene. Due to the level of decomposition, as well as insect and animal activity, the victim's face was unrecognizable and her right ear was missing. She did have strawberry blonde hair, which was 9.5 inches in length, but the decomposition made it impossible to obtain any fingerprints from her. It was estimated that the victim had been dead approximately 2 weeks before she was discovered. It seemed likely that she was dragged to the spot beneath the cedar tree, as the belt loops on her jeans were torn, though she was not sexually assaulted. One of the victim's most distinct features was her number 19 lower left molar, as the tooth had been drilled about 1 week before her death. This was presumably done in preparation for a root canal, but while the procedure was never completed, a dissolved aspirin was found in the tooth's cavity. The case would be investigated by the Coconino County Sheriff's Office, and while the medical examiner was unable to determine the victim's exact cause of death, it was suspected that a homicide had taken place. Since the girl's hyoid bone wasn't broken, and there was no other noticeable trauma on her body, it was theorized that she may have died of suffocation or asphyxiation. Unfortunately, all attempts to identify the Jane Doe went nowhere, but since she had been discovered on February the 14th, she was given the nickname Valentine Sally. After Valentine Sally's death made the news, a couple of eyewitnesses came forward who were certain they had interacted with her. One of them was a Northern Arizona University student who claimed he had picked up a teenage girl hitchhiking on February the 2nd. The pickup took place at Cortez Junction, located at the intersection of Arizona State Route 69 and Interstate 17, and as they were traveling north, the girl told the driver that she had been living with friends in Phoenix and working there as a dishwasher. Due to some family problems, she said she needed to get to New Jersey, as she was hoping to be dropped off at the Little America truck stop in Flagstaff in order to hitch a ride with a trucker. While Flagstaff was located about 45 miles east from the spot where Valentine Sally's body was found, but a more intriguing sight of her took place at the Monte Carlo truck stop, located just outside the community of Ash Fork. This account was provided by Patty Wilkins, who worked as a waitress at the truck stop since it was owned by her family. According to Patty, a blonde teenage girl matching Valentine Sally's description stopped by there during the early morning hours of February the 4th, and Patty found it unusual that someone her age would be there in the middle of the night. The girl was in the company of an unidentified white male who appeared to be in his 50s and was between 5'8 and 5'10 and of average weight. He was dressed in a brown, two-tone, checkered pattern leather vest and wore a black felt cowboy hat with a large peacock feather on the front. Since she had a teenage daughter of her own, Patty said that she always made it a habit to keep a close eye on young girls who showed up at the truck stop in the company of strange men, so she asked this girl if she felt safe and told her she could spend the night there if she needed to. However, the girl assured Patty that she did feel safe with this man and would leave with him, and since they appeared to be comfortable and relaxed together, Patty figured the man may have been a relative, such as a father or an uncle. There were two details Patty provided which convinced investigators that this girl was Valentine Sally. Patty said that the girl was wearing a white sweater with red stripes, and when shown a photograph of Sally's clothing, she confirmed that this was what the girl had worn at the truck stop. While the older man ordered breakfast there, the girl said she did not want to eat anything because she had a bad toothache. This prompted Patty to crush a baby aspirin tablet into powder and apply it to one of the girl's teeth, which was located on the left side of her mouth. And of course, a dissolved aspirin had been found in the cavity of Valentine Sally's number 19 lower left molar. The spot where Sally was found was only about 3 miles down the road from the truck stop, so it seemed apparent that she may have been killed and dumped at that location by the unidentified older man a short time after they left. Based on Patty's descriptions, composite sketches were created and circulated for both Valentine Sally and the man. Patty always felt tremendous guilt about not having done more to prevent Sally from leaving the truck stop, so she took the initiative to raise money and collect donations to pay for a headstone for her. Since she still could not be identified, the victim received a headstone with Valentine Sally engraved on it and was given a funeral and proper burial at William Cemetery. Over the next 2 years, the Coconino County Sheriff's Office would work tirelessly to try and identify Valentine Sally and excluded over 1,600 missing girls as being her. Well, in August of 1984, it was announced that Sally had been positively identified as Melody Eugenia Cutlip, a teenage girl who had ran away from her home in the unincorporated community of Estacada, Florida. When she was only 4 years old, Melanie's parents had divorced, and she lived with her father in Arkansas until he died in November of 1978. After spending some time in foster care, Melody eventually moved to Florida to live with her mother, Edith Gervais, and two of her half-brothers, but she never felt that she fit in there and was quite unhappy. As a result, Melody decided to run away from home in June of 1980 and was officially reported missing by her mother. Several weeks after Melody took off, she phoned one of Edith's neighbors and asked her to pass along a message to her mother that she was okay, but this was the last time anyone ever heard from her. Even though Melody seemed like a promising candidate to be Valentine Sally, making an exact match would prove challenging since there was no DNA testing back then, and Melody did not have any dental records for a comparison. However, an identification was made possible by Dr. Homer Campbell, a forensic odontologist from the University of New Mexico. Dr. Campbell used an analog photographic enhancement technique to enlarge a photo of Melody in which she was smiling and displaying her teeth. After comparing the photo with dental records of Valentine Sally's teeth, Campbell became convinced they were a match. In addition, Melody bore a close resemblance to the composite sketch featuring Sally's facial reconstruction, so a death certificate was officially issued for Melody, who would have been 3 weeks past her 16th birthday at the time she was killed. However, Melody's mother, Edith, refused to believe that her daughter was Valentine Sally and would not travel to Arizona to claim her body. One detail which troubled Edith was that Sally had moles on her chest above her right breast, which Melody did not have. Sally remained buried in Williams Cemetery, but Patty Wilkins once again raised money for a new headstone which had Melody Cutlett's name, date of birth, and date of death engraved on it, with Valentine Sally engraved underneath them in brackets. Well, things would go in a shocking direction in September of 1986, when one of Edith's former neighbors in Estacada received a visit from Melody, who was still alive. After running away from home, Melody had spent the past 6 years traveling around the country working various odd jobs and struggling with drug addiction. However, Melody eventually got clean and was now engaged to be married to a man who made woodcrafts. They resided in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and frequently traveled around the country in a camper as sales representatives for a woodcrafts company. Since they were heading towards a swap meet in Jacksonville, Melody decided to stop by her mother's former residence in Estacada. She left a note on the front door asking Edith if she could send some of her personal possessions and family photographs to her address in Baton Rouge. After learning that Edith no longer lived there, Melody paid a visit to her former neighbor and was shocked to learn that she had been identified as a murder victim from Arizona and legally declared dead. It wasn't long before Melody spoke to her mother and half-sister on the phone, and they would soon have a face-to-face meeting in Jacksonville to confirm that she was still alive. So needless to say, Melody was officially ruled out as being Valentine Sally, who became an unidentified decedent again. Melody's name was subsequently removed from Sally's headstone and replaced with the name Jane Doe. In a tragic postscript to the story, on September the 11th, 1998, Melody was driving through Jackson Parish, Louisiana on Interstate 10 during Tropical Storm Francis when she lost control of her car and collided with an oncoming truck, causing her to lose her life at the age of 32. For the next 2 decades, Valentine Sally continued to remain unidentified, but her case would be assigned to the Coconino County Sheriff's Office Cold Case Squad, a group of retired volunteers with law enforcement backgrounds. In 2015, there was hope that Sally might wind up being identified when a Michigan woman named Jeannie Phelps became convinced that Sally might be her long-lost sister, Carol Ann Cole, whom she had not seen in 35 years. Carol had gone missing from Texas sometime in 1980 when she was only 17 years old, so a DNA profile was created for her. While it turned out that Carol was not Valentine Sally, her DNA did wind up matching another murdered decedent known as Bossier Doe, who had been found stabbed to death in Bossier Parish, Louisiana in January of 1981, so she was positively identified. I'm sure many of you are already aware that when genetic genealogy was used to identify Joseph James DeAngelo as the Golden State Killer in 2018, it became a game changer in criminal investigations, and over the past 5 years, the same method has been used to identify hundreds of John and Jane Does. The Coconino County Sheriff's Office Cold Case Squad figured that genetic genealogy might help them identify Valentine Sally, so they had DNA extracted from one of her preserved blood samples. A match was eventually made to DNA in an online database which belonged to a first cousin of Sally's, and this allowed investigators to trace Sally back to a family from Bellefonte Neighbors, Missouri, which is an inner-ring suburb city of St. Louis. When DNA samples from this family were compared to Sally's DNA profile, they turned out to be a genetic match. On February the 22nd, 2021, the Coconino County Sheriff's Office announced that Valentine Sally had been positively identified as Carolyn Celeste Eaton, who would have been 17 years old at the time of her death. Carolyn was one of six daughters born to Donald and Isla Eaton, and in an odd coincidence, Donald had passed away in December of 1978 at the age of 49, around the same time period when Melanie Cutlip lost her own father. According to Carolyn's sisters, they last saw her sometime between Christmas and New Year's in 1981, when they returned home to find Carolyn with two unidentified men they didn't know. After a heated argument ensued, Carolyn angrily stormed out of the house, and this was the last time her family ever saw her. Over the course of the next month and a half, Carolyn somehow traveled 1,400 miles to Coconino County before she turned up dead. Sadly, Carolyn's mother Isla passed away in March of 1997 at the age of 66, without receiving any answers about what happened to her daughter. However, by the time Carolyn was identified, Patty Wilkins was still alive and agreed to be interviewed by the local media, expressing her relief that Carolyn's family finally had answers. Patty also said that she was willing to turn Carolyn's remains over to her family so that she could be buried in her home state of Missouri, stating, quote, "We've got a name, and I'm no longer in charge of her. I love you, and I'm glad you're going home," end quote. Of course, this case is still not entirely solved, as we do not yet know who was responsible for Carolyn's death. Obviously, the prime suspect is the older man who was seen with Carolyn at the Monte Carlo truck stop, but he has never been identified. The investigation into Carolyn Eaton's murder is still ongoing, but the identity of the perpetrator and the actual circumstances of how she wound up dead continue to remain unsolved mysteries. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So whenever I look at older cases like this, I constantly say to myself, thank God for DNA and genetic genealogy. I mentioned earlier that the identification and arrest of the Golden State Killer over 5 years ago pretty much opened the floodgates when it came to resolving cold cases, as it became apparent that genetic genealogy would become an effective tool for linking unsolved crimes to the perpetrator and identifying John and Jane Does. I was familiar with the Valentine Sally case for years before genetic genealogy became a crime-solving tool, and once it became standard practice, I figured it was only a matter of time until Sally got her name back. And sure enough, it was announced that she was identified in February of 2021, just 1 week after Valentine's Day. However, until I started researching the case for this episode, I had no idea that she had once been mistakenly identified as Melanie Cutlip back in 1984, and of course, I wound up cringing once I started reading the details about how that happened. Of course, back in the mid-1980s, DNA testing had not yet become a tool in criminal investigations, so the best method for identifying decedents was through dental records. But if dental records were not available, such as with Melody, it seemed like the best method of identification was, well, throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. As you can imagine, I rolled my eyes when I read about how forensic odontologist Dr. Homer Campbell simply looked at an enlarged photograph of Melody's teeth and compared them with Valentine Sally's dentals and figured they were a match. That is hardly what you would call an exact science, and it's even scarier to think that Dr. Campbell was called upon to testify in a number of criminal trials to share his analysis on bite mark evidence. But we now know that this is not an exact science either, and during the 1980s, Campbell's testimony played a role in the wrongful murder convictions of at least two defendants, Stephen Chaney and Joe Sidney Williams. Campbell shared his belief that the bite marks on the victims matched the defendants, but they were both exonerated via DNA evidence years later. So it's not hard to imagine how Dr. Campbell could have been so off the mark when it came to identifying Valentine Sally as Melody Cutlip. Believe it or not, this is not the first case I've covered on The Trail Went Cold in which a mistake like this was made. Other examples I've covered include the disappearances of Mary Elizabeth Edens and Mary Agnes Moroney, who both vanished while they were toddlers, until adult women came forward during the 1950s who believed they were the missing child. Of course, there was no DNA testing back then, and neither of the missing children had dental records, but both these adult women were identified as the child through junk science and guesswork, and it was not until decades later when it could be conclusively proven that these identifications were wrong. Of course, the situation with Melody Cutlip was a unique variation of this, because instead of a living person being falsely identified as a missing child, a deceased victim was falsely identified as someone who turned out to be alive. When Melody's mother refused to believe that Valentine Sally was her daughter, everyone pretty much thought she was in serious denial, but her instincts turned out to be correct after Melody resurfaced 2 years later. Melody was completely unaware that she had been declared dead and mistakenly identified as a murder victim, but back in the pre-digital world of the 1980s, it was easy to keep on living your life without hearing about something like that. So once again, we should be incredibly grateful that DNA technology has advanced so much that mistakes like this are unlikely to happen anymore, and there is zero doubt that Valentine Sally is Carolyn Eaton. Right from the outset, everyone assumed that Carolyn was a runaway who did not live in Arizona, which is why no one came forward to identify her, but it was still pretty shocking to learn that she had lived 1,400 miles away in Missouri and managed to travel that distance when she was only 17 years old. Back on episode number 93 of this podcast, I covered the story of the Walker County Jane Doe, a teenage girl who was found murdered along Interstate 45 in Walker County, Texas in November of 1980. She has since been identified as 14-year-old Sherry Jarvis, and much like Carolyn Eaton, she traveled a great distance before she was murdered, since Sherry had originally run away from her home state of Minnesota. In both cases, it seems like Sherry and Carolyn managed to travel across the country via hitchhiking, but eventually crossed paths with the wrong person who killed them. In many of these recent cases involving the identification of John and Jane Doe's, the victims were never officially reported missing, because it was often quite difficult to convince law enforcement to devote any resources to searching for runaways back then. In other cases, a missing persons report was filed, but information just didn't travel as quickly back then, so no one ever put two and two together. It has always been standard practice for online sleuths to search through missing persons databases in an attempt to find potential matches to unidentified decedents. But more often than not, when one of these identifications are made, it turns out the victim never had a profile page at any of the missing persons' websites, and there was no information about their disappearance online, and that certainly turned out to be the case with Carolyn Eaton. So the most likely explanation for Carolyn's murder is that she was killed by the unidentified man she had been seen with at the Monte Carlo truck stop in Ash Fork, but there are still a lot of missing pieces to the puzzle in order to figure out how she wound up in this situation to begin with. The other major eyewitness sighting in this case was provided by the unnamed Northern Arizona University student who was certain he had picked up Valentine Sally hitchhiking at Cordes Junction. This encounter took place on February the 2nd, and the girl said she wanted to go to the Little America truck stop in Flagstaff in order to hitch a ride with a trucker. The sighting of Carolyn at the Monte Carlo truck stop took place during the early morning hours of February the 4th, so theoretically, if she was the hitchhiker, she could have encountered her unidentified male companion in Flagstaff, who subsequently drove her 50 miles west to Ash Fork. However, the issue is that the hitchhiker told the student that she was planning to travel east to New Jersey due to, quote-unquote, family problems, but Ash Fork is in the opposite direction. We now know that Carolyn hailed from Missouri, so I'm not sure if she had any ties to New Jersey or any reason to travel there. So could the student have picked up a completely different girl and mistaken her for Valentine Sally? Well, if Carolyn was the hitchhiker, for all we know, she could have completely fabricated her story about traveling to New Jersey, so that has no bearing on this case. It has been established that Carolyn ran away from her home during the last week of December of 1981, but we really don't know any of her movements over the next month and a half, or how she traveled from Missouri to Arizona. If investigators have dug up any new information about this, they have not shared it publicly. The hitchhiker did say that she had been staying with friends in Phoenix and working as a dishwasher, and I'd be curious to know if any evidence has been uncovered to indicate that Carolyn was living there during January of 1982. However, while it's still up for debate if Carolyn was the hitchhiker, there seems to be zero doubt that she was the young girl seen by Patty Wilkins at the Monte Carlo truck stop on February the 4th. Not only did Patty accurately describe the clothing Carolyn had been wearing at the time her body was found, but she also said she gave her an aspirin tablet to combat a toothache, and dissolved aspirin was found inside Carolyn's cavity. Before we analyze this sighting any further, we have to give a ton of credit to Patty Wilkins, who is an unsung hero in this story, and went out of her way to raise money for Carolyn's headstone, even though she did not even know her identity at that time. You can tell that Patty was a genuinely empathetic person because she said that when every young girl showed up at the truck stop who appeared to be in distress or in the company of suspicious men, she would not hesitate to call the police and provide these girls with shelter until they got the appropriate help. You can tell that Patty was truly haunted by the fact that she never did the same thing with Carolyn, but even though her instincts told her that something might be off, Carolyn did assure her that she felt safe with this older man, and Patty got the impression that he might have been a relative. This is why I was glad to learn that Patty was still alive to learn about Carolyn's identification in 2021, as I'm sure that provided her with some peace that Carolyn got her name back and her family finally got to find out what happened to her. Since Carolyn was found murdered only a few miles away from the truck stop, it's reasonable to assume that she was killed by the man she was with a short time after they left, and he dumped her body next to the interstate. But it's worth mentioning that even though they were seen at a truck stop, it's never been officially confirmed if this man was a truck driver, as it does not sound like Patty or any other eyewitnesses saw them arriving or leaving in a specific vehicle. But since Patty described Carolyn as looking relaxed and comfortable with the man, you have to wonder what led to him killing her almost immediately thereafter. Now, I will add the disclaimer that in spite of its close proximity to the truck stop, Carolyn's body was not found until 10 days after she left, so we can't say with 100% certainty that this man was her killer. Yes, it is the most logical explanation, but theoretically, he could have dropped her off somewhere, and she wound up crossing paths with another individual who killed her. While law enforcement is inclined to believe that Carolyn's death was a homicide, they did have to acknowledge that they were unable to determine the exact cause of death, though they suspect it might have been the result of suffocation or asphyxiation. However, one theory I have often seen in online discussions about this case is that Carolyn may have actually died from some sort of infection. A very unique detail about this case is that one of Carolyn's teeth had been drilled in preparation for an apparent root canal, and based on Patty Wilkins' account, the tooth was providing Carolyn with a lot of discomfort at the truck stop. So the alternate theory I've seen mentioned is that the infection in Carolyn's tooth may have become so bad that it turned fatal, and she wound up succumbing to something like sepsis, or even an allergic reaction to antibiotics she may have been given. This could go a long way towards explaining why it was so difficult to determine Carolyn's cause of death. Even if her male companion was not directly responsible for her death, he may have panicked if she died in his care, so he decided to dump her body alongside Interstate 40. But while this is a fairly intriguing theory, there's still a number of holes with it, as dying as the result of an infected tooth would not account for why Carolyn's sweater and bra were removed and she was found nude from the waist up. And if Carolyn did succumb to sepsis or an infection or an allergic reaction, I'd like to think that this would have shown up on her autopsy, though given that this was the early 1980s, I suppose something could have been missed. But overall, I am inclined to think that suffocation or asphyxiation is the most likely explanation for Carolyn's death, and she was the victim of foul play. While Carolyn was not sexually assaulted, the removed clothing might indicate that an attempt at a sexual assault was made, which wound up escalating into violence. I find it very strange that no shoes were found at the scene, so unless Carolyn had been traveling barefoot, I wonder if perhaps her killer decided to keep her footwear with them as a souvenir. But getting back to Carolyn's tooth, the fact that it had been recently drilled always made people surprised it took so long to identify her. When I learned that Carolyn had been living with her family in Missouri, I initially wondered if she had undergone some dental work there before she ran away to Arizona, but the medical examiner seemed to believe the tooth was drilled only 1 week before she was killed. Yet investigators were unable to turn up any dentists who recalled performing work on Carolyn, which is all the more surprising, since the tooth had apparently been drilled in preparation for a root canal. Root canals are generally performed over the course of at least 2 dental visits, so this would seem to suggest that Carolyn had a follow-up appointment scheduled, which she never showed up for. While it's easy to assume that Carolyn had her tooth drilled in Arizona, we have a month and a half gap when her whereabouts are unaccounted for, so for all we know, she could have seen a dentist in another state before she arrived. If she went to see some sort of illegal, unlicensed dentist who only accepted payment in cash, this might explain why no records of any visits could be found for Carolyn and why her tooth was continuing to bother her. Regardless, it still would have cost money for Carolyn to undergo such a procedure, and I'm not sure that a 17-year-old runaway could afford something like that on her own. So could this mean that Carolyn had a traveling companion, such as the unidentified older man, who paid for her dental work on her behalf? Whatever the case, the key to figuring out what happened to Carolyn is identifying the man from the truck stop. Interestingly enough, when Melody Cutlett was confirmed to be alive in September of 1986, some news articles reported that 2 unnamed people had been eliminated as suspects in Valentine Sally's murder after she was identified as Melody. But now that this identification turned out to be mistaken, these people were considered to be potential suspects again. Unfortunately, the authorities did not provide any further details, so I have no idea who these individuals might have been, and if they are still considered to be potential suspects all these years later, now that Carolyn has been identified. However, if you search through online discussions of this case, one person who has been listed as a potential candidate to be the man from the truck stop is Royal Russell Long. Now, I will add the disclaimer that law enforcement has never publicly named Long as a suspect or person of interest in Carolyn's murder, so his potential involvement is based on nothing more than pure speculation, but I still think he is worth discussing. In summary, Royal Russell Long had a long history of sexual violence towards female victims, and even though he was suspected of being a serial killer, he was never officially convicted of any murders. Since he worked as a long-haul truck driver, Long frequently traveled around the country, and in 1984, he was living in Evansville, Wyoming. On September the 18th of that year, Long picked up a pair of hitchhiking Native American girls who had run away from their home of Eagle Butte, South Dakota. 12-year-old Sharon Bald Eagle and a 15-year-old friend of hers known only as Sandy. Long took both girls back to his residence and offered them $100 for sexual services, but when they refused, he tied them up at gunpoint and proceeded to beat up Sharon and rape Sandy. Sandy soon managed to escape and notify the police, but by the time they arrived at Long's residence, he had fled the area with Sharon. 1 week later, Long was tracked down and apprehended in Albuquerque, New Mexico, but Sharon was not with him. Even though the authorities believed that Long killed Sharon, they could not find her remains and lacked the evidence to charge him with her murder, but he still wound up pleading guilty to 2 counts of kidnapping for the purpose of committing indecent liberties with a minor. Long received 2 life sentences, and in November of 1993, he died of a heart attack in prison at the age of 58. Over the years, the authorities have attempted to link Long to a number of different cold cases. In 1974, Long was living in the town of Rawlins, Wyoming, and in July and August of that year, no less than 4 young female victims went missing. 19-year-old Carlene Brown, 19-year-old Christy Gross, 14-year-old Deborah Meyer, and 10-year-old Jaylene Dawn Banker. Christy and Jaylene's remains were eventually found, but Carlene and Deborah are still missing to this day, and none of these cases have ever been solved. Three of the four victims went missing while visiting the local fairgrounds, and since Long often worked at fairs and carnivals, he has been looked at as a potential suspect in all these cases, though no conclusive evidence has ever implicated him. However, at one point, Long did get charged with the disappearances and presumed murders of two teenage girls who went missing in 1981. On September the 26th of that year, 13-year-old Charlotte Kinsey and her 13-year-old friend Cinda Pallett went to a carnival at the Oklahoma State Fairgrounds in Oklahoma City. At one point, Charlotte called her family from a payphone to let them know that a carnival worker had offered her and Cinda jobs, assisting him with unloading plush toys from his truck, but this turned out to be the last time either girl's family ever heard from them. Indeed, a number of children who attended the carnival would later share the same story about being approached by a man who offered them jobs unloading plush toys. This included two teenage boys who claimed that a man driving a Pontiac Grand Prix gave them a ride to a truck stop off Interstate 40, while two girls who were believed to be Charlotte and Cinda were in the back seat. According to the boys, the man dropped them off in the parking lot of the truck stop, gave them $10, and told them he was going to go get his truck, but after he drove off, with the two girls still inside his vehicle, they never saw him again. The man was described as being around 35 to 50 years old, between 6'1" and 6'3", between 200 and 250 pounds, and having dark hair and a full dark beard with gray streaks. He also wore silver, wire-rimmed glasses and a straw cowboy hat, and seemed to match the description of Royal Russell Long. Well, after Long went to prison on the kidnapping charges years later, investigators started looking at him as a potential suspect in the Oklahoma disappearances, and there was some very compelling evidence against him. While Long denied any involvement, he did admit to having visited the Oklahoma State Fairgrounds on the night Charlotte and Cinda went missing, as he traveled to Oklahoma City to deliver a flatbed trailer to a local business. During this trip, Long had rented a Pontiac Grand Prix, which matched the description of the car the two teenage boys had climbed into, and they, as well as many other witnesses, positively identified Long as the man who had been offering children jobs at the carnival. The Grand Prix was also tracked down and searched, and hairs and traces of blood were found inside. But of course, since DNA testing did not yet exist, it could not be conclusively proven that the hairs or the blood belonged to the two missing girls. Regardless, even though Charlotte and Cinda's remains had still not been found, the authorities believed the case against Long was strong enough that they decided to formally charge him with two counts of kidnapping and two counts of first-degree murder in August of 1985. Long's trial took place in December of that year, but due to some procedural errors, a good chunk of the evidence against him was either thrown out or ruled inadmissible by the presiding judge. Before the case could go to the jury, the judge ruled that the remaining evidence against Long was insufficient for conviction, so the kidnapping and murder charges were dropped. In spite of this, the consensus still seems to be that Long was responsible for killing Charlotte and Cinda, but they are still technically missing to this day. Long was returned to prison to continue serving his sentences for the kidnapping, but was never charged with any more murders before he passed away. So it's safe to say that Royal Russell Long was quite a terrifying individual, and I can totally believe he was a serial killer that was responsible for the murders of a number of young female victims. Even though he was never convicted of the crime, I definitely believe that he killed Charlotte Kinsey and Cinda Pallett, and since that crime took place just over 4 months before Carolyn Eaton was murdered, could Long have been the unidentified man seen at the Monte Carlo truck stop with her? Even though Long resided in Wyoming, we know that his work as a truck driver and carnival worker allowed him to travel all over the United States, and while we can't be certain he was in Arizona in February of 1982, it's certainly not beyond the realm of possibility. If you search online, you can find a side-by-side comparison between a photograph of Long and the composite sketch of the man from the truck stop, and you can see similarities and differences. The man was described as being in his 50s, and Long would have been just under 47 years old at that time, which is close enough. There are discrepancies in the height and weight, because when Long was spotted at the Oklahoma State Fairgrounds in September of 1981, He was described as being between 6'1" and 6'3" at around 200 to 250 pounds, whereas the truck stop man was supposedly between 5'8" and 5'10" and of average weight. Of course, Long wore glasses, and the man at the truck stop did not, and the biggest difference is that the truck stop man was clean-shaven, whereas Long sported a beard most of the time. However, I did find a photograph of Long which was taken following his arrest in September of 1984, and he was not wearing his glasses and only had a mustache at that time, so he could shave when he wanted to. Hell, maybe he decided to shave off the beard to disguise his appearance after his visit to the Oklahoma State Fairgrounds because there were so many witnesses there that could identify him. I mentioned earlier that Long has never been publicly named by law enforcement, so I'm not sure if he's ever been investigated, but since Patty Wilkins is still alive, I'd be curious to know if she has been asked to look at a photograph of Long in order to confirm or deny if he was the man she saw with Carolyn. Even though Long is deceased, it is still possible to conclusively link people like him to unsolved cold cases through DNA profiling and genetic genealogy, but the problem is that I don't get the impression there was any DNA found on Carolyn's body which belonged to her killer. Regardless of whether the perpetrator was Long or someone else, I think the key to figuring out who is responsible for this crime is piecing together Carolyn's movements during the window of time between when she ran away from home in Missouri and was murdered in Arizona. I have no doubt that investigators have attempted to do this since Carolyn was identified over 2 years ago, but we haven't heard of any new developments since then. At the very least, Carolyn did get her name back, and her family finally received answers about what happened to her, but this case will never be satisfactorily resolved until her killer can be identified and brought to justice. And piecing everything together might require someone to come forward with information. So if you happen to know anything about the murder of Carolyn Eaton, please contact the Coconino County Sheriff's Office Cold Case Squad at 928-226-5033. That's 928-226-5033. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, we have released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes which are all currently available in our archives. And this past month, I released an episode about the 1995 death of David Chase, which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries and supposedly involved a murder victim returning from the grave in order to provide information about how they were killed. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unexplained 2002 death of Jamie Stickle. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Louis B. and Matt R. Thank you so much for your support. Anyway, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code, which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets. So in order to do so, please visit crimecon.com and use the special promo code COOL23. That's COOL23. I also wanted to mention that The Trail Went Cold will be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. We've got a specialized promo code you can use in order to get a 15% discount on tickets, so if you would like to do so, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use our promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com and the promo code is TRAIL. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.